Snapper, it's your boy Glenn, and I'm so proud we've got a fantastic show for you. Some of my favorite stories of all time. But know this, D-Day approaches. Friday the 13th of May, I meet with some folk about the future of Snap, your show. I need to tell them you're on board. So let me march in, sit down, kick my feet all up on the table, and tell them that 5,000 Snappers have our back. Don't mess with this show. So far, 670 Snappers have answered the call. Each and every one gets big love. Join them. Donate right now at snapjudgment.org. That's the only way this happens. This is your thing. Only you can make it go. So pause the show. Pause it. Go to snapjudgment.org. Give $2 a month, $2,000, whatever you can. Then listen without guilt. Snapjudgment.org. Okay, so blame Michael Jackson. But when I was a freshman in high school, I wanted a Jerry Curl, right? But I didn't have Jerry Curl money. So I got the discount kit from the drugstore. And instead of a trained professional hairstylist, I had my brother, who said he read the instructions on the box. I told him what I was going for, with the waves and the shine. And I wanted that Michael Jackson baby curl to fall just so on my forehead. My brother assured me it would be no problem. He said it was gonna hurt and I better not holler like a nerd boy though. All right, he opened up the box. Toxic chemical smell burned my nostrils. Is it supposed to smell like that? Shut up, don't move. He twisted the top off the foul smelling jars. Smell like a slap. Tears stung her eyes. He put on the plastic gloves that came with the kit, reached in for a big scoop of the angry gelatinous mess, and smeared it on my virgin scalp. Felt like someone hooked an electric cable to my head. I screamed like a nerd boy as my scalp boiled.
Shut up!
Tried to hold on, I tried, but finally, I dived under the tub faucet and let it go full bore. Water, 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 water. It's the only thing that can stop the pain, water. Shut up. I didn't even realize I was still screaming. Next day, I strolled down the halls of East Kenwood High School with my hair looking exactly like Michael Jackson. Girls, check me out sideways, what's up? I rocked the lean in my step, like I had jumped out of a Thriller video.
Woo!
That day, one glorious day,
jam on.
But the next morning, clumps of my hair stuck to the pillow. I run to the mirror. A horrified scarecrow stares back. Patchwork carpet of stuff falling out of his head. And my brother laughs. told you. This all comes back to me 2 days ago, walking down the street in Oakland, when I spy an old school brother, hat to the side, pocket handkerchief, red pants with a cuff in the crease, when he slides his fedora off, Jerry curls. Lord, like I so badly wanted back then, he smiles at me and I smile back and wonder if perhaps under the mattress, coat pocket, maybe, just maybe, I could find some Jerry Curl money. Today, on Snap Judgment, from WNYC,
Throwback.
Amazing snap stories from back in the day. If you rock Jerry Curls with a parachute pants, everyone will know that you're listening. To Snap Judgment. Yeah, we're celebrating here at Snap with some of our favorite stories since we launched. And today we're starting out with a story that takes us right over the bridge to San Francisco. Snap Judgment.
I first found Nico by staring at the sidewalks, and I did that because I was recently laid off from my job at the Chronicle. one of my favorite things was always to kind of get lost in San Francisco and stare at things that I normally might have looked past. And then I saw his name written in the sidewalk, Nico. And I thought it was interesting. And then a block later, I found his name again,
Nico.
I turned a corner through Chinatown into North Beach, and I found another one. You know, I would find them not just in North Beach, but Chinatown, Russian Hill, Telegraph Hill. They would be references to the street name, like Nico on Filbert or Nico on 9th, Nico downtown. And then the personality of me was really coy. It was like,
Nico is here, Nico gets it all.
What was interesting is the order in which I found them was sometimes kind of synchronistic and uncanny. I think I was late for a job interview, and so I'd say, man, I'm getting compulsive about this. And then I'd look down and say,
Nico, concrete compulsive.
And I remember once I was just saying to myself, damn, Nico is everywhere. And then I looked down and it said,
Nico is everywhere.
I certainly felt close to him in the sense that, like, I felt like a duty. And I remember thinking that this is my duty to write this story. And then coincidentally, I'd run across a clue that said,
Nico on duty.
So whether I liked it or not, I felt like I was getting close to him. I made a lot of presumptions, and that was what you had to do to sort of profile who would do this. First of all, I knew it was a guy, because it didn't seem like something a girl would do. And I figured he didn't have a father in the picture. The question was, how could he do this without anybody finding out and saying, hey, don't do this anymore? And these clues would go from 1967 to, I think, about around 99, 98. Because I saw the date 1967, I figured, well, he must have been about, I don't know, 12 years old. In some ways, I got to watch him grow up because I felt like his personality kind of got a little more bolder through the years. Earlier stuff might just say
Nico.
And later on, he would call himself
Nico Concrete Artist.
The most fascinating clue I'd ever come across in the sidewalks was a question.
Who is Nico? Just why does he?
And it was the rest of the question was cut off by a new section of sidewalk. You know, I want to know, is this guy alive? Why did he do it? But it was obvious that I was doing something weird. I took pictures of all of these things. So anybody taking photograph of, you know, something on the sidewalk, people would always kind of look through the corner that I was that guy doing, you know. It was the first time I'd ever felt like I was the one paying attention in class. It was like, you know, doesn't anybody else care? So I thought for a minute, well, maybe he worked for concrete contractors. And so I would run into the workers who were there on the job and ask them, sometimes right as they were actually about to tear out an eco from the sidewalk. And they would be like, what, you know, I gotta get to work, kid. My image of him was based on a borrowed face because I went to high school with a guy named Nico. He was a tough kid. He was a tough city kid. Went to juvenile hall and all that sort of thing. And so I had pictured this Nico as kind of being the sort of artful dodger of San Francisco. I figured he went to school in the neighborhood, so I went to the high school, Galileo, and I went to Francisco Middle School. And so I would start photocopying yearbook pictures from the 60s and 70s. And I would base this on guys who looked like they just had that kind of James Dean look in their eye. It was by the North Beach Playground. I believe it was rainy day, and rainy days were always the best days to read the concrete because it washed away a lot of the dirt and you could read things that on other days you probably couldn't see. And I saw this etching that was the longest that I'd ever seen. It took up an entire sidewalk block. It was like a paragraph. And at first I thought, no, it can't be him. I think it said,
America's a great country, built by the white man, owned by the Jew, ruined by the...
And then the first word began with an N, but I can't actually say for sure. I mean, I can presume what it said, and you probably can too, but that those letters were actually washed away from foot traffic. And then I'd found quite a few others, and it was, you know, we're talking 10, 15, 20, and in some cases right by an eco, in other cases directly below. And as far as I could tell from the handwriting, it was Nico. I didn't want to believe it, because it didn't go with, you know, what I identified with. I mean, to some extent, I wanted to identify as the kind of loner kid in the city, too. And this happened right before I finally found him. As far as, like, the Sherlock Holmes work, it all came together. Kind of felt more like Sam Spade. By that point, 3 years into it, I had spoken to the story to quite a bit of people and asked, if you ever hear anything about it, let me know. And so one of those finally came through, and someone said that they had met him. And then she called me back and just remembered it, and then that's how I found him.
Who knows who Nico is? A handful of people?
My godfather, my sister, my best friend.
How did you never get caught?
Pretend like you're tying your shoes.
Pretend like you're tying your shoes.
It's the oldest trick in the book, or pretend like you dropped something.
How many do you think you've done?
1,000.
1,000, huh?
I'm just picking 1,000 out of the air.
At least 1,000.
At least 1,000, yeah. My thoughts were that if I do this really deep and do it right, this stuff will last way into the future, and it'll be like the concrete will be all washed away with the pebbles poking up. My name will still be there.
How far in the future were you visualizing this lasting?
Oh, after I was dead.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just figured if I do it, maybe 5,000, maybe 100 years from now.
It's kind of like any story you get into when you have a hunch about it. A lot of it was very close to what I had imagined, and a lot of it was completely different. He did have a very artful Dodger lifestyle. His father was out of the picture, and he had a very bohemian upbringing with kind of like a real carefree parenting style from his mother, who was an artist and was friends with musicians. And he was just this kind of kid who was sort of, in some ways, forgotten.
I pictured Nico as being kind of tough and maybe out on his own, beating other kids up.
I wasn't tough. I
never beat anyone. Well, this is where I'm wrong in a lot of things. And that's the thing that I've learned, that I've been wrong. And that's kind of where I'm at. I mean, I would see a ban all non-white immigration over by the Stockton Tunnel, and then I'd see it over on Russian Hill. There's how about white race consciousness, keep America white. I mean, about 12 or 13 of them in the same block of cement, I'd also saw the name Nico. And
let's jump ahead. You probably want to know, did I write that stuff?
Well, I'll be straight up honest with you. I think you did.
That would be Billy that wrote that. That really long, complicated.
Uh-huh.
Do you know how much effort it would take to write that in wet concrete?
Who else would know?
Man, I get in there. I was in there. I was bending down, tying my shoe, as all people saw, and I was out of there.
I can pick out about 15 to 20 that seemed to me would be the same guy who did Nico, who would be you. But if I'm wrong...
Here's the deal, look. Okay. When I was a kid growing up in the city,
yeah,
I'm talking a little kid, on Sunday, we would go to a march in Oakland for civil rights, for a peace march. On Monday, I'd go to school, and I'd get the shit kicked out of me by the very people that we were out putatively trying to help. And this sounds absurd now, but it was all in my mind, it was all put together. What I did was, I thought, what is the one thing I can do that will really bug my mother and her friends? Well, if you get right down to it, how does a boring suburban kid rebel against their parents? They go to the opposite extreme of what the parents believe in, right?
This is...
Well, how does a kid that's being like raised by a bunch of beatnik peace activists, civil rights marchers, rebel against their parents?
Sure.
But I repent.
Totally, I understand.
I'm a hardcore green activist now, man.
Yeah.
Have some more cheese, man.
Thanks.
We've got to finish this up. It's been sitting out.
Sure.
So, what are you going to write, man? You told me you were going to write this thing about Nico.
I am writing about Nico. And that's why I'm trying to figure out who is Nico, why he does it. And I think I feel like I found out. I don't think that you technically wrote all these things. I think Nico did. And I think there's a difference between you and Nico, and I think Nico is pretty much that he's gone.
I've not written my name, but I've written his name in wet concrete. In fact, that was the first line I wrote for the story. It was in the sidewalk. Walk up Montgomery Street toward the Union Street steps and make a right at Green Street. And right there, unless someone's double parked on top of it, it should still say, I found Nico. Big thanks to Delphine Vigil for sharing your story at the Snap. That piece, it was produced by Snap's OG, Stephanie Fu, a signature piece. We love it. Now, this is Storytelling with the Beat, and our own Pat and C.D. Miller spoke with MC Homeboy Sandman about his embrace of the music.
I think this is 2008. When I found out what my true inner passion was, that I was a musician, I said, yo, I'm not losing focus. For me, I'm like, I'm not getting caught up in a rat race. Right now, the things that I'm gonna do for money, it's all gotta be related to my rhymes. I'm nickel and diming it, selling CDs, doing shows. I'm trying to make it work. You know, I had managed to pay some rent. I got this fat crib, but then, you know, soon after moving in, fell behind. Falling behind, and the landlord is like, yo, I'm not feeling it. Trying to evict me all types of times. I've been to court on multiple occasions. Comes to a point where I am 5 months behind on my rent. I'm 5 months behind, all right, at almost a grand a month, $5,000 in the hole. So I make the decision, when I go to court tomorrow morning, I'm going to tell the judge, I give up, I ain't got no money, I'm going to get out of the place, right? Okay. So next morning I wake up, walk over to the courthouse. When I get into the courthouse, I got to speak with the court clerk, right? I speak with this woman, and for some reason, who knows why, she's like, yo, what are you going to do? You're not going to give the place up, right? I'm like, what do you mean? You have the record in front of you. I have no money. She says, don't give up. You have to tell the judge you'll get it. Tell the judge give you 15 days. Whatever you got to do, you can't give up. This is the court clerk, mind you. She's supposed to be on their side. I said, miss, what am I supposed to do? She looks at me with a look in her eye, like she cares about me, like she feels real concerned for my well-being. And she's like, yo, trust me, B, get 15 days. So I say, all right, fine. She just talked me into telling the judge that I was going to have the money in 15 days. I go in front of the judge. I say, judge, 15 days, I'll have it. Judge, of course, says, what do you mean 15 days, you'll have it? I said, 15 days, boom, that's, you know what I'm saying? Despite the fact that I clearly have no idea where the money's going to come from, the judge says, fine, and he gives me 15 days. It doesn't make any sense. Nothing that happened in court that day made sense. I leave, just flabbergasted, and when I get home, sat down, turned the computer on, took the internet that I was stealing from somebody else's internet in the building, and the first email I see, Tag Records, MC competition today, this afternoon, Rucker Park, grand prize, $5,000. Grand prize, $5,000. And when I see this, I feel like a feeling washing over me, or just like, you know, magic of some sort of, or divine intervention for real. You know what I'm saying? The prize money was what I owed on this very day. I feel like all I gotta do is show up, win, which is obviously gonna happen based on the psychosis that just took place in the courtroom. And this is crazy to me.
You know what this is. Hey.
It's Jermaine Dupri's Tag Records, right? And I go over there. This place is packed. Rucker Park jam-packed, fence to fence, okay? And the crowd was nuts. It was deranged out there. This particular competition, it wasn't a rap battle. It wasn't predicated on dissing each other, trying to cut each other down, which is something that I personally do not get down with. Instead, it was a let's see who could rap incredible competition, which of course I was built for.
So somebody's getting a $5,000 grant, that's correct?
Definitely, without a doubt. I mean, that's what the whole tag.
It started off with like 40 MCs, right? Each round, the winner was determined based on crowd noise. The cats who get the loudest response are gonna go, you know, to the next round. And everybody got up in the first round and spit their bars and all that. Of course, I get up there. Boom, I shut it down with a verse.
Oh, crap! Oh, God, files on the ball open. People found me out smoking, I'll be out smoking. People in their house smoking, I'll be out voting. Don't get broke by the potent.
From the beginning, the crowd is loving me like crazy. Obviously, I'm on to the next round. Next round.
It is what it is, and it isn't what it was, and what it ain't. Is another dime a dozen, I don't covet, I create. When there's nothing in my cupboard, I'll be guzzling V8. I'm concerned about how the government and governor behave. I'm fed up with all the rubbish that the youngins emulate.
Yes, can't nobody rhyme like me, and it's always been that way. So it becomes apparent that I am the crowd favorite, with the exception of one other person. Is this kid named Cash Flow. I remember the kid's name, Cash Flow. And Cash Flow was from across the street. He was from the building across the street and knew half the people in the park. I get to the last round. Comes down to me and Cash Flow. Cash Flow and I were going back and forth, and the crowd was just maximum noise. Couldn't get no louder each time. The judges keep going, all right, go again. So we go about three extra rounds. And there was really no way to differentiate his crowd noise from my crowd noise. So they had to go and get this decibel noise meter reader. Once they brought the noise meter out, they had us do one more round. and I went first.
The most aggressive professor versus the senses and self-sense of the message. I'll take adventures with my father in heaven.
And I got bars until the earth stopped spinning. So I spit all types of bars, right?
My soul with soldiers is shoulder to shoulder versus the soldiers that pull us over the soakers with hoses.
And the crowd made gigantic, stupendous, enormous noise. And you look on his device and it was super loud. And I'm like, yo, he's not gonna top that, this kid. You know what I mean? So then he gets up.
I mean, I thought I told y'all, come through the boy flow, known for the roll call. Listen here, dog, all I do is get cake. We bought 3 sixes out, we on the L day.
He spits his bars and, you know, I'm not trying to downplay him. He could rap.
Make some noise for cash flow, y'all.
And, like, I don't know if his cousins was there, mother, brother, aunts, uncles, aunts, sisters, sister-in-law, grandparents, whoever was there, they went berserk for him. They was screaming, people was getting nosebleeds. They went as wild as they can. And you look at the device when he was finished, I was down by 0.02. When they announced that he had beat me by those 0.02, you know, I try to never feel bad if I do my best, and I know I had done my best, but it didn't even make sense. I was like, nah, this can't, it can't be. It can't be that I didn't win this, you know what I mean? Like, he got it by the most slenderest of margins, that it's just like if a bird flew overhead, the bird's wings determine the outcome of the competition. And that was it, and he read it off, and the crowd was majorly like, no, hell no, yeah, hell yeah. This is Tag Records when Jermaine Dupri was doing the Tag Records thing. A couple of minutes later, Jermaine Dupri emerges.
Listen, and it's so close. Y'all ain't
okay, he comes out, steps out on the stage, and he says, yo, it's a tie. Jermaine Dupri, you know, because he know his hip-hop, he said, this Sandman kid is not going to lose to this kid, Cash Flow. It's a tie. Done deal. They both gonna get the money. Words to the mouth. It was beautiful. It was beautiful. Maybe we'll have to split this and I'll get a nice $2,500. I'll go back to the judges $2,500. He'll be like, all right, I'll give you a little more time. Yo, they gave me the full 5 G's. They gave me the full 5 G's. Okay? As if I had won the joint outright. As it turns out, I got evicted 5 months later. Okay, I got evicted 5 months later. But in the 5 months that winning that competition bought me, such significant things happened in my career. The day that I got evicted, the next day I was leaving for 3 weeks to be on the road. The moral of the story is, go for it, son. Go for broke. You know you're going for broke because you broke. And when you go for broke, God is going to look out. And Jermaine Dupri is going to look out too. Peace.
My sixth sense keen. I seize the existence squeezed between a herd and scene. My urban streets got rivers and streams. Burke and D.
Big thanks to Homeboy Sandman. Find out more about his world at homeboysandman.com. That piece is produced by Pat Masiti Miller. Now, when Snap returns, we're going behind bars and we're going to steal a dog. In Snap Judgment, the throwback episode continues. Stay tuned. Snappers, our own secret weapon put that story together. Pat Masiti Miller. Pat is the mixologist that directs the whole sound of this show. He spoke with Homeboy Sandman. Now, can you imagine Snap without the beats? Without the sound, without the music? That's toast with no butter. It's surf with no board. We all together need Pat to work with musicians that make Snap snap. And if you appreciate the hours and hours of effort, most of our stories are scored with original music created by Pat, by Renzo Gorio, by Leon Morimoto. It's like making an album every week. If you appreciate what it takes to get that done, donate now to make sure it happens. Snapjudgment.org. And for just $3 a month, we're going to send you a link to the Snap Funky mixtape so you can bop your head to the beat. For $4, I'll send you the mixtape and the Best of Snap Judgment Live. So pause this. Pause the program. Support the show that supports you. We're counting down to Friday the 13th. SnapJudgment.org. Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the throwback episode. Today, we're looking back at some of the pieces that stuck with us over the years. And one storyteller has stayed with me. Donald Cabana spoke to Snap's Anna Sussman about his time employed at Mississippi State Penitentiary. This piece does touch on some dark topics. As such, listener discretion is advised.
One of my earliest jobs, I was a corrections officer at the state penitentiary at Parchman in Mississippi. Spent 12 hours a day on a horse out in the middle of the cotton fields. The inmates worked. The work was brutal. Corporal punishment was the order of the day. What fascinated me most, however, about Parchman was the trusty shooter system, where inmates, selected inmates, carried guns and guarded the other inmates on what we called the long lines that worked out picking cotton or vegetables or whatever. Everything was done by hand. It was at one point in time known as perhaps the most dangerous prison in America. I saw myself as a reformer, and I very foolishly and naively criticized in a newspaper interview one day the fact that the prison had been through 6 superintendents in less than a year and a half. And so I was critical of the governor for that. I was summoned to the superintendent's office, and I was summarily dismissed and told to go clean out my office and that I would be escorted off the grounds by a state trooper. We get out the front gate, and I said, you see that sign up there over the gate? And he said, yeah, where it says superintendent. I said, I'm going to come back here as the warden one of these days, or superintendent, and my name's going to be up there. It was 15 years later, the day that I arrived at Parchman as warden. My reputation as the warden there was that I was one tough SOB. I ran a tough prison. I knew that at some point in my career, I would probably be faced with that task of executing somebody. The method at that time was the gas chamber. I don't think any person who takes on a warden's job, they better do it with the eyes wide open. You go into it understanding that this may be part of my job. And if I'm not willing to do this particular part of my job, however infrequent it might be, then I shouldn't take the job in the first place. Edward Earl Johnson was the first execution that I actually presided over. He was executed for killing a town marshal about 3 months after he graduated from high school. Shortly before the execution, the weekend before, we were having Sunday dinner. I told my wife, and she looked at me and she said, are you ready for this? And I almost flippantly, nonchalantly said, hell, I've spent 20 years in my career being ready for this moment. Combat in Vietnam. And she said, I think you're going to find that those are two very different experiences. I said, well, maybe so. But look, it goes with the territory. And if I'm not willing to do it, I don't deserve the job, and I'm not going to lose any sleep over it. He was an interesting guy. Most inmates, you know, on death row are going to tell you they're innocent. But usually, when you get right down to It's time to do the deed. The inmate will come around. He may not just come right out and say, okay, I did it. But they might say, would you tell my family I'm sorry for the pain I caused them? Please apologize to the victim's family. Well, you know, you're not going to do that if you didn't do something. But in his case, at the point in time that I finished reading the death warrant, when it was time to ask him if he had any final words, he is strapped into the chair inside the gas chamber. I leaned down and I just kind of whispered to him and said, Edward, it's not important that anybody in this room hears you say, I'm guilty, I did it. But what is important is that you're at peace with your God before I have to give the order to do this. And I thought to myself at that moment, hey, that's pretty strong stuff. That's pretty good stuff. He looked at me and said, Warden, I'm at peace with my God. How are you going to be with yours? I'm innocent. And those were his last words. I'm innocent. By the time we finished the press conference, it was about 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning, and we started walking back to the house. By that time, things had started to kind of set in a little bit. The reality. I came back and told my wife. She said, how was it? I said, it was horrendous. It takes too long. It's potentially extremely, excruciatingly painful. We're supposed to be better than they are. While I was doing this, everybody else in Mississippi is asleep. And I've been busy doing their dirty work for them. I climbed in the shower, and I scrubbed and I scrubbed and I scrubbed because I felt dirty. I said, if I never have to do it again, I won't be sorry. One's enough for me. I don't know how folks in Texas do it. 6 weeks later, it got worse because I did my second execution. Only in this case, the guy, interestingly, never denied his guilt. Connie Ray Evans. The problem was that I had become extremely close to him. That happens sometimes. It's inexplicable. It breaks every rule that wardens have about don't get close to the cons. The line between the keepers and the kept is a thin one, because he's a human being. And that's what we're not supposed to lose sight of in this business. And my wife used to warn me, that guy's going to burn you. And I said, look, out of all the inmates on death row, Connie's the best behaved, never causes any problems. He's as quiet as a church mouse. She said, I'm not talking about him escaping or hurting anybody. He's going to burn you. He sends you birthday cards. You go down there and you play checkers with him. He's gotten under your skin. You're much too close to him for your own good. What's going to happen if his time comes while you're the warden? And lo and behold, 2 weeks later, the attorney general and the governor called and said, we're going to have another execution in 30 days. And I said, okay, who is it? And they said, let's see, a guy by the name of Connie Ray Evans. And I was just stunned. You know, 3 hours before his execution, I was sitting alone in my office, and I went through his prison file, which I'd been through 100 times, and I found something I had just never noticed before, and it was stuck on the backside of a piece of paper, and it was a picture of him in the third grade. We've all had those. Miss Kelsey's third grade grammar school picture. And I stared at it, and I thought, you know, he looks like the 9-year-old next door, the 9-year-old kid across the street. He looks like my 9-year-old kid. Even though I'd not forgotten what he was there for, when I would read his record and read the details of the crime, I would try to envision him doing what that record said he did. And the inmate that I dealt with on a day-to-day or week-to-week basis, it was difficult to envision that. It was a moment of stupidity caused by drugs or alcohol or whatever. I had instituted very liberal visitation policies for prisoners facing execution. His mother, when I had to tell her it was time for the visit to be over, I went outside the building to smoke a cigarette, and she came outside and she came up to me and she put her hand on my arm and she thanked me, and she said, "I know you have children. Please don't kill my child." And those words rang in my ears. I went back to my house that evening, and I just wanted to hug my kids and not let them go. The night of the execution, when it was time to walk the mile, I went to his cell. We went to his cell to tell him it was time to go. And Connie was very popular with the other inmates. He was popular with the staff. So we started walking him down the row. And the inmates, as we passed their cells one by one, started saying goodbye to him. And the officers who worked on the row, I had allowed them to come in. And those officers had all gathered up at the end of the block by his cell. And they were all standing here with these big burly guys, you know, with tears in their eyes. And about halfway down the row, somebody, one of the inmates, started very softly singing Amazing Grace. And by the time we got to the end of the row to go into the last night room next to the chamber, the entire cell block was singing. I remember thinking as we were walking down the tier on death row with him, I wonder if his knees are buckling because mine are. This is tough. You know, it was the 30 minutes or so in the last night room was really awkward. We talked about mundane things. I found myself saying really awkward things to him, like, "We're going to go through this together. I'm going to be with you every step of the way," knowing that, well, not exactly every step of the way, because I'm not strapping my butt into that chair. We got him into the gas chamber, and we were strapping him into the chair, and I read the death warrant, and when I asked him if he had anything to say, he said, "I want to tell you something privately. I just want you to know that I love you." To be honest with you, I think for an instant I wanted to tear up, but hell, I'm the warden. And I've got a team of employees that are expecting me to be a leader. And you don't do that if you're out there boohooing about executing somebody that murdered another human being, no matter how much you might have liked him personally. We were closing the chamber door. He said, "Wait a minute, warden, I have one more question." And I stepped back in and he said, "How do I do this?" And I said, "Look, you're going to be able to see me through the glass. When the gas begins to rise up, you look at me and I'll nod my head and you take a couple of deep breaths. and I promise you it's going to be over very quickly. Which, of course, was not true. When the red phone rang, of course, he heard it. And it's almost, I reached out, the deputy warden handed it to me, but I never took my eyes off him. We were fixated on each other, and I took the governor's call, and I just looked at him and shook my head. I realized about a minute and a half into it, I looked at the doctor and I said, Jesus, he's holding his breath. Of course, he couldn't hear me through the glass, but I said, breathe, damn it, breathe. And he was still holding his breath about 2.5 minutes into it, and I kind of banged my fist on the glass and said, breathe. It took about 4.5 minutes before he lapsed into unconsciousness. I found myself standing there wondering how we both got there. How had our lives come together under those circumstances? I went home and I told my wife, okay, you were right. I shouldn't have got close to him. And I told her what he said. And she began to cry a little bit, and she said, but you're wrong about something. And I said, what? She said, you will come to treasure the fact that you knew him the way you did. And you'll treasure for the rest of your life what he said to you. I do. I was reflecting on a dinner conversation with my children one night, and my oldest daughter all of a sudden just said, do you worry about being forgiven? I did struggle very privately from time to time with the issue of my judgment. Last year, all of a sudden, I went into congestive heart failure, and it caused my kidneys to fail, and it got real complicated and touchy for a while. And I just remember laying there praying the rosary, thinking, I want to make sure I've covered as many of the bases as possible in terms of seeking forgiveness and redemption. The executions were part of my conversation with my God. I remember, you know, my priest was standing there with me, and I'm praying. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, we're not different from some inmate on death row.
Since this piece originally aired on Snap Judgment, Donald Cabana has passed away, and I want his family to know how much his openness touched us and how much his story haunts. This piece was produced by Anna Sussman. When Snap returns, we're going to do a bad thing for a good reason. Stay tuned. Rest in peace to the amazing Donald Cabana, who recently passed away. He left us a gift. And Snappers, I love this story. I love the rapport, the openness Anna Sussman developed with Donald so that he felt comfortable opening up. And it happened because Anna went down to meet him. Not on the phone, in person. Anna sat down, drank some sweet tea, and when he was ready, she asked him to tell his story. We need Anna to go meet people. That's the only way this happens. So help me send Anna away. You need her stories. And your donation of just $3 a month, $5 a month, helps get Anna a ticket out of here. Go to snapjudgment.org. And you need her to get immediately. Otherwise, she's going to stick around and tell stories about her cat
Don't let it happen. Make Snap Snap at snapjudgment.org. Don't wait for someone else. No one else is listening to this podcast but you. For $7 a month, I'm going to send you a special members-only live stream to Snap Story Meeting. You can see Anna, see the Uber producer, the whole team hash it out. Help us decide what goes into a brand new episode. Join the live stream for just $7 a month. Look, you expect amazing storytelling. It doesn't happen unless Anna leaves. Send her gone. Support Snap at snapjudgment.org. From WNYC, welcome back to Snap Judgment, the throwback episode. My name is Glenn Washington, and yes, we've saved you the very best seat in the house. Snap Judgment, live.
I stole something from a homeless person. One day I walked outside of my apartment and there was a dog just sitting there in my driveway. I could tell the dog was sick, but there was nobody around and the dog didn't have a collar, so I just put her in my car and dropped her off at the animal shelter. And a week later they called me to say that nobody had claimed the dog and she was too sick to put up for adoption, so they were going to euthanize her that afternoon. Now, I didn't want that on my conscience, but I knew that I couldn't take her because my apartment didn't allow dogs. And even if it did, I just didn't want that responsibility. But nevertheless, at 5 o'clock, I was back at the animal shelter picking up the dog. And my plan at the time was to sneak her into my apartment, nurse her back to health, and then find her a home as quickly as possible. And I really didn't want to get attached to this dog, so I purposely didn't name her. But then one day we were walking and this homeless guy started yelling, "Anne, Anne!" And that's when I discovered that not only was her name Anne, but she had been raised on the streets and knew all the homeless people. And suddenly I was cool with all the panhandlers. And it was like Hate Street had become this giant, filthy nightclub. And I was dating this girl who knew everyone that worked there. But the turning point came when I met the ex. She was a 16-year-old runaway named Sheila. And she came up and hugged Anne and thanked me for taking care of her and started to take her back. And when I asked her where she had been, she said, you know, the Presidio. And when I asked her why she hadn't been looking for Anne, why she hadn't gone to the shelter, she said she just figured someone else was watching the dog. And that's when I kind of snapped. I don't know if you've ever had this experience when all your politics get in a cage fight with your better judgment. I mean, Sheila was clearly the dog's owner, and it wasn't for me to tell her how to live. But legally, the dog belonged to me. I had adopted her just minutes before a death that Sheila did nothing to prevent. So I finally told Sheila that she could have Anne back if she could get herself in a stable situation where she could keep a dog. I even offered to let her use my apartment, my bathroom, my phone, my computer, anything except live there, if it would help her find a place. Sheila made a counterproposal, which was essentially that we have a duel. She and I would stand about 20 feet apart with Anne in the middle, and then we would each call to the dog, and whomever Anne ran to would be her owner. But I felt that the possible gain in legitimacy wasn't worth the risk of losing the dog, and I turned her down. Plus, I didn't know what sort of secret street treat she might have to entice the dog. I mean, Anne was still very much part of that world. Sometimes I'd even, you know, when nobody was looking, I'd even lay down on the sidewalk myself just to see how happy it made her. So over the next month, I found I was really falling for this dog. I mean, she was smart and affectionate, and having grown up on the street, she wasn't freaked out by strange people or commotion. She was the perfect dog. And ironically, the more attached I grew to Anne, the more empathy I had for Sheila. But then one day my brother called to say he had finally found a woman in LA who would take the dog. So that weekend I drove Ann down to LA and dropped her off at this woman's house. But the moment I got back in my car, I just started crying. I kept thinking about a friend of mine who had gotten married really young. She said that she wishes she had met her husband later in life so that she could have experienced more life as a single adult. But she knew that if she waited until she was ready to get married, somebody as perfect as her husband wouldn't have been around. I knew that I wasn't ready for a dog, but I felt that when I was ready for a dog, I wanted it to be Anne. And then I suddenly turned the car around and raced back to this woman's house to beg for Anne back. And a few minutes later, I was standing on her doorstep getting a lecture about how unfair I was being because the woman's cat had just accepted Anne. And the cat would be very upset if Anne left. But eventually I wore her down and got Anne back. So now I had basically stolen the dog from two women and a cat. And on top of that, I had to find a new place to live. So I bought a house. And as I was packing up my things to move out of my apartment, I got a phone call from Sheila. She said that she and some friends were going to travel around the country in a camper so she could finally have Anne back. And I said no. And that was it. Now I was the homeowner denying the homeless. I felt like I had become the man to whom I'd always wanted to stick it. You know, there are some stories that we tell so often they become a routine. This isn't one of those. Instead, I gradually worked up a story that was very sweet and heroic and absolutely true, despite the fact that it made no mention of Sheila. And I told that story so many times that I'd almost allowed myself to forget about this part of it. I mean, it happened 11 years ago, and I got a house and a great dog as a result. And I haven't seen Sheila around in years, which is good because I hope that she's doing well. I hope that she's healthy and living in safety and comfort, but I'm still keeping the dog. Thanks.
Big love to Scott Kravitz. Original scores by Alex Mandel is performed by Alex and the Snap Players, Tim Frick and David Brandt. Now, if you want to tell your own story, at work, at home, on the stage, or on the page, Snap can help. We're going to have a special session on how to tell the story you were born to tell. Information at snapjudgment.org. You can see the video of Scott's performance. Just find Snap on the Facebooker. Well, it's about that time. Not to fear, Snap Nation, because the dance just got started. More storytelling awaits your pleasure right now. Even if you missed the moment, or if you didn't, subscribe right now to the amazing Snap Judgment podcast featuring stories you can't get anywhere else. Pictures, movies, stuff. Right now at snapjudgment.org. Snap was produced by myself and the most bashful, retiring, aw shucks group of producers ever to storm a Beyonce concert. Please give it up for the uber producer himself, Mr. Mark Ristich. His beats can't be contained. Pat Machini Miller, faster than a speeding bullet, Anna Sussman, Stephanie Fu, stolen by the overlord of all media, Style Garep. Julie DeWitt has spider senses. Joe Rosenberg carries a buck knife. Nancy Lopez swings on the trapeze every Tuesday. Davey Do Run Run Kim, Renzo the Animator Gorio, our nighttime crew, Eliza Smith, Honor Adlerstein, Matt Ducat, and Leon Morimoto. Jasmine Aguilera cannot beatbox. This is not the news. No way is this the news. In fact, you could enter a rap battle for rent money, lose, get paid anyway, and still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is WNYC. Snappers, Scott Kravitz rocked that story. And maybe you have a story of your own that needs telling. Of course you do.
know that Snap Judgment can help, because I'm going to live stream a special session on how to tell the story you were born to tell. On the page, the stage, at work, at the bar. Sign up right now at snapjudgment.org. Or maybe you want to see how the sausage gets made here at Snap. Well, you can become a virtual behind-the-scenes Snap producer, because we're going to throw back the curtain and live stream a Snap story meeting. You get a backstage pass and help decide what goes in and what stays out of a new Snap. See Anna Sussman and Davey Kim fight it out. You're going to dig it for just $6 a month. And did I mention both of these gifts include the Snap mixtape and the best of Snap Judgment live downloads? Get it all right now at snapjudgment.org. Snapper, you are at the end of a show. You listen to the whole thing. Think about that. It's not the first time this has happened or the second time. You know how special this is. Support the show you depend upon. Snapjudgment.org.